This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Sue Drabi, Karen, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Becca Staley. For those staying with us, we will continue our broadcast for four more hours today, including the inauguration. If your station isn't running us, you can go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:02. Coming up next is more talk radio with guest host Linda Olson Osterlin. Today's guest is Trevor Aronson, author of The Terror Factory, Inside the FBI's Manufactured War on Terror.
KBOO Radio is a proud media sponsor of the 28th annual Martin Luther King Day event. Keep Alive the Dream, an annual tribute to Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., produced by the World Arts Foundation. This year's event will take place at the New Beginnings Conference Center, 3300 Northeast 172nd Place in Portland. KBOO will again broadcast the annual celebration in its entirety. More information about this live broadcast can be found at kboo.fm/2013MLK.
This Wednesday, January 23rd, KBOO will broadcast live from downtown Portland, where the Illihi Lecture Series kicks off its 2013 lecture series, Who Owns You and What You Can Do About It. With award-winning author, activist, and food policy expert Raj Patel speaking on Who Owns Our Food.
In every food riot that has happened, you've seen a demand for food linked to a demand for political change.
That's 7 this Wednesday, January 23rd. For tickets to the talk, go to illihi.org or listen live on KBOO Radio 90.7 FM.
To know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but build to destroy. Well, you play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes. And then you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. And like Judas of old, well, you lie and deceive.
Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to More Talk Radio. That was Master of War, covered by Martin Simpson, and I'm Linda Olson Osterlin, your host today. As most of you know, it's the federal holiday for Martin Luther King's birthday, and Cecil and Celeste are taking the day off to celebrate it. KBOO will be having special live coverage of the Portland celebration taking place at New Beginnings Conference Center starting at 11 a.m. The inauguration is also this morning. It doesn't start until after our show, so keep your attention here. I hope. And this is a call-in show. The number is 503-231-8187. Now, before, you know, go ahead and make your calls, but we're going to have about 20 minutes with my guest. You have, before I open the phone lines, you've probably all been hearing about it. In fact, you'd have to be avoiding all news media, and I do know some people who do that, to not have heard of the trial of alleged terrorist Mohammed Mohammed taking place in the downtown federal courthouse. We've been having live reporting from it every evening on the KBOO Evening News. You probably also know that his attorneys are saying he was an angry and mixed up young man who was entrapped by the FBI, groomed and set up by an agency desperate to prove its worth. There is no doubt about that, I don't think. I think it's going to be pretty easy to show, but whether that counts for legal entrapment, we don't know. And our guest can tell us more about how those kinds of cases can go because he's an expert on this. His name is Trevor Aronson. He's the author of The Terror Factory, Inside the FBI's Manufactured War on Terrorism. This book is just out. It's really great. I read it over the last week. Well worth you reading. Most of the cases that he goes into in it were not ones that I was familiar with. There's a surprising number of similar cases happening throughout the country. Trevor is the co-founder of the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting. He's an investigative journalist and an award-winning one as well. His reporting for Mother Jones on the FBI's use of informants in Muslim communities won numerous awards and provided the basis for him to go forward and write the book that I got to read this weekend. He will be reading from The Terror Factory at Powell's Books on 10th and Burns tonight at 7:30 p.m. I'm so glad to have him joining me 12 hours before that. Welcome, Trevor.
Yes, thanks for having me.
You know, everybody in our community is aware of the FBI and its activities around Muslims and terrorism, at least as far as it touches here in Portland. There's been multiple cases. And I've heard more than one people say, these are all setups, these are entrapments. But, you know, we can say that, but we don't have any proof. Can you tell us how you came to writing this book and investigating this story?
Yeah. So for me, it started in 2006. I was a reporter in Miami, and the DOJ and the U.S. Attorney's Office in Miami announced the indictment of these men who became known as the Liberty City Seven. And these were seven guys who were living in the poorest section of Miami, and they allegedly plotted to bomb the Sears Tower and bomb the FBI office in North Miami Beach. Later, it turned out that these guys had no money whatsoever. They had really no assets. They were running a drywall company that was failing. And yet this was a case that Alberto Gonzalez, the attorney general at the time, described as being a plot to wage full ground war on the United States. And so for me, it just...
A plot to say the words again, because the hyperbole is big in these early cases.
Right. And, you know, in the beginning of these cases, early on, the government really oversold them, in my view. And so in this case, the Alberto Gonzalez held a national press conference and says, we've arrested seven guys, and they wanted to wage full ground war on the United States of America, which on its face is ridiculous, right?
Yeah.
How can seven guys wage full ground war on the United States? So that really got me thinking as I was reporting on the story, and then I realized that the informant played the largest role. You know, these guys were people that the government portrayed as being connected to Al-Qaeda, but their only connection to Al-Qaeda was an undercover FBI informant who was posing as an Al-Qaeda operative. You know, these guys never had any actual specific connection to Al-Qaeda. And this FBI informant had offered them all kinds of inducements, had at one point was saying he was going to transfer $50,000 to their bank account, was saying, you know, are you guys ready? Let's come up with some sort of attack. And when the guys finally agreed and said, okay, we were interested in some sort of attack, he said, okay, well, what do you guys need? What do you need to carry forward with this attack? And the first thing they can think of, because their drywall business is failing, is work boots. And to me, it was hysterical, because this is a group of guys that the government is portraying as dangerous terrorists. And when asked what they need for an attack, they say work boots. That was in 2006, and I didn't get on that immediately. And then I started to see more and more of these cases come up. And in about 2009, I became really interested in trying to document how many of these cases existed, how many cases where the government had charged someone with terrorism, alleged that they were a dangerous terrorist and was on the eve of committing some sort of attack, but on their own never had any capacity, that it was the FBI agents or the FBI informants who provided all of the capacity they needed. And what we're seeing now, such as in the case of Mohammed Mohammed, is a national program that the FBI and the DOJ have where they use these sting operations that are really an evolution of the drug sting operations from the 1980s, where, you know, you'd have a situation where someone, an FBI undercover agent, for example, had an empty briefcase and some guys come in to buy it and they believe it's cocaine and they come in with their cash and they put it on the table. And then when they hand over the briefcase, they realize it's empty and the FBI storms in and
arrests
them.
Agents are, yeah, we can see this on TV pretty much any night.
Yeah, exactly.
This has been switched the channels and there'll be a show of
exactly.
Something
it's
like
been
that.
Glamorized by Hollywood and, yeah. You know, countless times. But essentially what we have in the case of Mohammed Mohammed and, you know, cases of about 150 other defendants since 9/11 is a situation that's very similar. But instead of an empty briefcase of drugs, instead of an empty briefcase that's supposed to hold drugs, it's an inert bomb or disabled assault rifles that are all provided by the informant. And in all of these cases, like in the Liberty City 7 case, like in Mohammed Mohammed, the defendants never had true connection to Al-Qaeda, never had a specific connection to Al-Qaeda, never had the capacity to obtain weapons on their own, but an FBI informant or undercover agent is able to provide those weapons, and then the government is able to charge them with conspiracy to commit an act of terrorism or conspiracy to use a weapon of mass destruction, as if they were as capable on their own when the evidence shows that they clearly weren't.
Well, and I go back to a time when we thought, when we mocked and said it was horrifying to think of thought police, and that people should never be put in jail for their thoughts or speech, you know, or what they say. And yet I'm not sure that I can see that without the FBI in most of the cases, and you list a lot of these cases in detail, that they would have had any, you know, it would have gone anywhere at all, literally.
I think that's definitely the case. You know, I think when we talk about this, it's worth noting what the FBI views. You know, what the FBI is fearful of and what the U.S. government is fearful of is, you know, after 9/11, we feared the second wave attack, a group of trained terrorists that was going to rise up and commit another act of terrorism.
And I want to get in while you say that, you know, because I was skeptical of that. Did we really fear a second attack? But I've been covering this long enough to know that even if somewhere up above there, you know, on the highest levels, there was a conspiracy within the United States to create 911, to, you know, this was that kind of event, still throughout the offices of the FBI and the branches of the FBI and other federal governments, what the on-ground people were told and what they believed was there's going to be another attack, there could be more of these, and there was real both a kind of frisure, a kind of fear, and a, oh my God, we've got to get on top of it. I hear this from reporter after reporter who've talked to people in far-flung areas of it. So
right, there was a, you know, apparently, or it's been reported that George W. Bush came to the FBI director right after 9/11 and said never again, and that became the policy. Whatever it takes, we don't want another attack. And what they began to realize in the years after 9/11 is that Al-Qaeda wasn't capable of, you know, sending another group of trained terrorists overseas and then, you know, unleashing a horrific attack. And instead, Al-Qaeda moved to what became known as a franchise model, where they put propaganda online, they put jihadi videos in the hopes of inspiring people already here to rise up and commit some sort of act of terrorism on their own. And the FBI refers to this threat as a lone wolf threat. You know, people who are here, who are disgruntled, who want to, you know, commit some sort of act of violence, and they become inspired by Al-Qaeda and commit this act of terrorism. So these FBI sting operations are meant to draw out the people who are on that line, you know, who are sympathizing with Al-Qaeda and maybe want to become terrorists, and then use these sting operations to draw them out and, you know, and prosecute them under U.S. law. You know, the problem is that the people that they're ultimately drawing out, while they say they want to commit an act of terrorism, while they certainly act at times that they want to commit an act of terrorism, they never on their own have the ability. You know, these are people that, you know, say they want to commit a crime, but on their own they can't. You know, in the case
by and large, they've never owned a weapon. They don't have the money to purchase a weapon. They've never used explosives. They don't have plans to know how to use explosives. I believe one of the informants was even shown how to use an explosive and then couldn't figure it out again and had to have someone come do it for him.
Right. Yes.
You know, and maybe with his thumb on it. Here, let me put your thumb on my thumb on top of your thumb. So it's your thumb. You push the button, not the informant. I mean, it's very, it gets comical in some of them. They look almost comical, except we're talking about real people, real lives, many of these people are convicted. If you're out there listening and you want to get in on this conversation, now's a great time to start. We're going to be going into different aspects of Trevor's investigation into this and more of the details about how the FBI have a really sort of well-organized way they go about it and how they share the same informants from area to area. Who are these informants? We'll go into all of that as we continue with the show, but we do have one caller on the line now. I'm sorry, it's Randy. Thank you for joining us today. Let's go ahead and hear what you have to say.
Ooh, that was quicker than I thought. I hope I can formulate a question. So you kind of paint a picture of impotence on the part of those who would want to hurt us, and of is a conspiracy of to create boogeymen on the part of the FBI, et cetera.
Well, I don't know if it's conspiracy, but it definitely involves wanting to make sure that the U.S. feels protected from terrorist danger, Muslim terrorist danger in particular.
Yeah, you know, I think I don't necessarily think this is a well-organized conspiracy by the FBI where they say, you know, we really want to create these boogeymen, we really want to get the Muslim community. What I make the argument for in the book is that it's really a bureaucratic issue. You know, every year the FBI gets $3 billion to fight terrorism, and that's more money than they get for organized crime, for financial crimes, and they can't, you know, spend $3 billion and come back to Congress and say, hey, we looked around, we didn't find any terrorists. And so there's a real pressure and incentive to build terrorism cases. And what ultimately comes of that is pressure on informants who are often dubious people, who are often criminals, to find people who say they want to commit some sort of act of terrorism and then lead them through the process in making a prosecutable case so that the FBI can say, hey, you know, we spent $3 billion and here we are protecting the homeland. Here are examples of cases where people were threats and we neutralized those threats.
And I think shortly after 9/11, they really wanted to show that they hadn't been caught flat-footed. I think the Portland 7 was a good example of that. They also used an informant in there. They also provided the computer. They also provided money for some weapons. That there was no real plan ever engineered to actually do any act of violence here in the United States. But when Ashcroft went on national news and announced that he had caught this ring of terrorists, you know, dug in Portland, it certainly had the effect of that I think they wanted.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a PR aspect to all of these cases, certainly, you know, an ability for the government to say, hey, we've done our job, or we're keeping us safe. And a lot of that is a reaction, as you said, to being caught flat-footed. You know, if you look at, you know, another example is this case outside of Buffalo called the Lackawanna Six. And, you know, in George W. Bush's 2002 State of the Union, he specifically mentioned that as, hey, we've caught a terror cell and they were outside Buffalo. You know, only later did we realize that these guys weren't a terror cell at all, that they went overseas to train before 9/11 and realized that being a terrorist is pretty hard and I'd rather go back and, you know, live my comfortable life in suburban Buffalo. And they were never on the eve of an attack. You know,
they could have been better recruited to be anti-terrorist and work with the police to talk to other Muslims about why they wouldn't want to go to it, because they didn't want to be one. But let's hear what you have to say about it, Randy.
Well, are you folks concerned that Mr. Obama is always crowing about bin Laden, and we still don't have any answers for the four men in Benghazi, and we still don't have any answers regarding Fast and Furious guns across the Mexican border? Are these things are of any concern to you folks?
Sure.
Absolutely. You know, the Fast and Furious scandal, if you want to call it that, I mean, it's definitely interesting. It's another example of a federal agency, in this case, the ATF, really misusing informants, really misusing mishandling how they're pursuing an investigation. And that's, you know, this is a similar example, right? Like in Fast and Furious, they put guns into the wild, so to speak, in order to trace them. And it's the same with these type of terrorism stings, where they're giving capacity where otherwise no capacity exists. And I think this is a really troubling thing. And, you know, I think this is something that you'll see, you know, already obviously Congress is looking at the Fast and Furious scandal. What we aren't seeing is the same attention being paid to these tactics used in other cases in counterterrorism particularly.
Anything else, Randy?
I think fast, man. So there really are enemies out there that would love to destroy us, because we see it in the Middle East, the mayhem and the lifestyle of terroristic Islamism. So is this a real concern to you? I'm trying to get to that.
Well, let's go into that.
Yeah.
I wanted, and we'll, And we're talking with, for the rest of you who are out there, this is More Talk Radio. This is Trevor Aronson, the author of Terror Factory, Inside the FBI's Manufactured War on Terrorism. And yes, that's one of the questions I wanted to ask him. Out of all of the cases, and if you can tell us how you got the information on these cases, that would be good. Out of all of the cases he investigated, I wanted to know, were there people really out there trying to hurt us, or were they all just these hapless people who had, you know, said things and then got targeted for entrapment by the FBI?
Right. So I'm certainly not making the case that Islamic terrorism is not a threat in any way. I mean, obviously, we see it overseas. You know, we see it in Mali right now in the most dramatic way. That said, if you look at the cases that have come in U.S. courts where, you know, federal prosecutors have prosecuted people on terrorism crimes, and you try to take a look at how many pose an actual threat, you can find some. You know, for example, there was Najib al-Azazi, who came close to bombing the New York subway system in 2009, and he was trained in Pakistan. There was Faisal Shahzad, who fortunately failed in trying to bomb Times Square. And so there are cases of people connected to international terrorism groups who have tried to commit acts of terrorism here. But as part of this investigation, I took a look at more than 500 defendants who had been charged with international terrorism. And what you can find are...
I didn't even realize we had 500 defendants charged with international terrorism.
Yes, yeah, so since then...
And thank you, Randy. We'll let you go and go on from here.
In the decade after 9/11, there were 500 people charged with terrorism. And, you know, as part of my investigation, one thing that was difficult early on was I didn't want this to be an anecdotal story. And what had been written about these cases before was anecdotal. You'd have a case here and a case there, and they would draw a pattern. I really wanted to do this as a data analysis. The problem was, well, how do you do a data analysis of terrorism prosecutions if you don't know the list, you don't know how the DOJ is defining it? And one of my early breaks came when the U.S. wanted to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the 9/11 mastermind in Manhattan, and Congress put up a fuss. And they said, well, is this really the right thing for us to do? Can we put on a safe and fair trial? And Eric Holder, the attorney general, brought to Congress a list of 400 cases, that 400 defendants that they said they had prosecuted successfully on terrorism since 9/11. And as part of that, they included the criteria for establishing whether something was a terrorism case. You know, there were two types, Category 1 and Category 2. Category 1 was things you would expect, someone using a weapon of mass destruction or hijacking an airplane. Category 2 were cases like immigration violations, lying to the FBI, other crimes where the defendant had some sort of connection to terrorism. And so a research assistant and I then took that list and took that criteria and updated it to the 10th anniversary of 9/11 and did a very systematic analysis. We went through every case. We looked for whether an informant was used, the role of the informant. You know, in some cases, an informant does what you would expect him to do. He provides information. In other cases, you have an informant who acts almost as an agent provocateur, who becomes part of the terror plot, who in some cases leads the terror plot and provides all of the means necessary. So what we can say is, of those 500 cases, there were a handful, like Najib al-Azazi and Faisal Shahzad, who posed real threats. But there were so many more. There were 150 who were caught in sting operations where they never had any connection to Al-Qaeda or any kind of international terrorism group other than the informant or the undercover agent posing as a terrorist and providing all of the means necessary for them to commit their crime.
And in those real cases, they didn't know about them far in advance, and the FBI wasn't on top of preventing those far in advance. And in the ones that they did, where the informant played the major role, they clearly could have known that this was not someone who could do it on their own. And I want you to talk more about that as we go forward, because many of these people tried to back out and say, no, I don't want to do a violent act. And yet still the FBI pushed them forward. So I hope that answers your question, Randy. We do have, it looks like the lines are full, so I want to go ahead and take the next caller. Jack, thank you for joining us.
Yes, I'm grateful for this research. I think that it's really important. And unfortunately, many people that go down this road of research and look at this kind of activity get labeled, unfortunately, labeled conspiracy theorists. We hear that a lot, and we hear it even at KBOO. I think that it's important in this investigation to really look back. We can look all the way back 20 years, in fact, shortly after the collapse of the Soviet Union, when we were looking at the possibility of what they call, what was being called the peace dividend at that time. But our bogeyman had collapsed, so time for another one. I think that in the context of Operation Gladio, if you remember what that was.
I don't remember what that is. What is that, Jack?
Operation Gladio was a terror campaign in Europe in the 70s primarily, 70s and 80s, when there was gangs like Biedermannhof, Red Brigades, these kind of gangs supposedly setting off bombs all over the place. And the investigation in the Italian parliament around 1990 concluded that it's actually a network that was set up as the stay-behind network, and they had caches of weapons all over the place, and these bombs were actually being set off to terrorize the public and convince them that that electing socialists and communists to their parliament was the encouraging groups like Red Brigade and Biedermannhof to do these kinds of acts.
So, in other words, you're saying that the acts they were doing were really being sponsored by the opposition.
Well, by a radical faction, let's put it that way, that was actually supported and trained by NATO. Anyway, in the and that's all documented in research that was done for and in the Italian Parliament. They had hearings about it. It can you can look it up. It's historical.
Okay.
Now, in the light of that, moving forward, I would bring your attention to the World Trade Center bombing in 1993, where there is evidence that that was, too, was a sting operation, but the sting went live. The explosive was supposed to be phony, but it was not. And one of the informants is on tape. You can look this up. Dan Rather covered it in CBS News. A number of people have followed up on it. And there is tape recording because the informant was recording his conversations with the FBI agent, that his handler, as it were. And it's there. Everybody thought the people were being set up, and it was going to be a bust, just like they do the operations for these days. But the explosives were live, and people were killed. Of course, six people were killed, and over 100 injured.
You're right. I mean, you know, in the 93 World Trade Center bombing, the FBI did have an informant inside that group, and he was telling them, you know, these guys are about to commit this act of terrorism, and the FBI was skeptical, and ultimately, if I'm remembering this correctly, pulled him out of the case. And then you ultimately had they went forward, and the informant, you know, told them what was going to happen, and the FBI didn't act fast enough. And I think that's a good example. Where that's different from a lot of the cases like we have here in Portland with Mohammed, you know, that was a group that actually had capacity. You know, they had connections overseas. They had the ability to put together weapons. What we're seeing now in these terrorism cases, though, is that, you know, the people that want to commit act of violence are not groups like that, and they're also not people who have the ability on their own to commit acts of terrorism. You know, they have no capacity for, you know, finding weapons, for building a bomb or anything like that.
Right.
So it's true that there's.
But I think what you have to look at even more deeply is that, I mean, here we are at the going back to WTC 93, and this is shortly after the war in Afghanistan between the Mujahideen and the Russians, and we know. We know that Brzezinski, Gates, their operatives, the ISI, essentially created Al Qaeda out of this, out of the Mujahideen, and then ran them in the Balkans, in Chechnya, in the Maghreb against the Algerians. It's commonly referred to as Al CIA. Okay, so who is running LCIA duh.
Well, Jack, I think if the point that you're wanting to make here is that the United States government and the FBI have been involved in more attempts to create scenes that would benefit them in terms of foreign policy and then blame it on the opposition and
It's an overarching
true.
Global war of terror. And the other thing that I think you have to be very careful to look at is rather than identifying a whole governments, whole agencies as being responsible for something, because there are many dedicated agents who really are serving the Constitution, but these agencies are not monolithic, and there are factions within them, and there are rogue networks within them, and who runs them? And to what end? Who are they serving?
Well, I think they're serving the ruling elite, is my guess, but I agree that there are factions within that. I'm going to thank you, Jack, and let you go. We've got two more callers on the line. Dan, go ahead and...
Yeah, hi, folks. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Trevor, I applaud your efforts and the attention it's receiving. To get all meta on you for a moment, I know you're published with Ig Publishing, which is a worthwhile but pretty small press. Can you tell me a bit? Were you able to get, given your high profile Mother Jones, were you able to get a literary agent? And tell us a bit about your route to getting this book out there, because there's a lot of stumbling blocks in the way to this kind of work.
Right.
And who, if dare I say, who is your agent if you obtained one?
In this case, I worked on this project with the University of California and Mother Jones Magazine, and I did not work with an agent for this project. I ended up taking this to the University of California Press and Ig. And Ig was by far the most enthusiastic. You know, they said they could promote it. They felt like this was really a book they wanted to do. And for me at the time, I just really wanted to find a publisher that was as excited about this one as Ig was. And I think, you know, that ended up being the right bet. You know, they've been very good about getting the book out there and promoting it. They were able to, you know, CBS This Morning, for example, did a segment on it. And I don't know if I would have necessarily had the same attention for this topic, because it is very controversial, as I would have with a larger press, and that was in big part why I chose Ig, and also because I thought they were doing really admirable work. I thought they had a really good distribution network. I liked the type of books they were putting out, and it just seemed to be a good fit.
Yeah,
can you talk a little bit about
the?
I'm going to interrupt you there, Dan. I want him to go on and talk a little bit about the start of this, like where you got the information. Tell him the story about how you even got the files to be able to know who to look at and how to investigate. It was Eric Holder at Congress, right? You mentioned that earlier.
I'll hang up, folks. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. So you were able to get this list of all these cases, and then you had to be underwritten to do this investigation initially. Were you just doing this on your own?
No. So I realized early on that this was an enormous amount of work to have to go through 500 cases, and you know each case is going to be hundreds, if not thousands, of pages. And it wasn't something I at the time had the capacity on my own for. And so Lowell Bergman, who's a journalist that most people know from the movie The Insider, where he was portrayed by Al Pacino, runs this program at the University of California, Berkeley, where he sponsors mid-career journalists who have a ambitious project, but they can't get it funded on their own, to come to UC Berkeley for a year and work on it with him. And so I pitched it to him, and I said, you know, this is, I believe, a really important story, not only about terrorism, but about the administration of justice in the United States. And fortunately, he said yes. That's what he wanted to do. So I was on salary there for a year and was given an expense account to pursue it, which allowed me to, you know, to have the time to have a research assistant to go through every case, to make frequent trips to New York and D.C. to interview to interview FBI agents who were in these
cases. I was
going to
say, you did a lot of interviewing of, you know, government and agents from the FBI, different levels of people.
Right. I mean, you know, an important part for me in this book was a lot of criticism that's made of DOJ and the FBI sometimes comes off as such being so much of an outsider as to be almost irrelevant, right? Like you can't really talk about these cases and be critical of them unless you're also talking to FBI agents who can tell you, yes, this is what was going on inside. This was the reason for our policies. This is what we believed at the time. And I've made I think, extraordinary effort to include that in the book, that even though I'm very critical of this policy, I wanted to tell the FBI story of how they came to this, the changes in the Bureau since 9/11, and why the FBI agents specifically think this is such a threat. I mean, obviously, this, you know, the FBI isn't monolithic, as the previous caller mentioned. I mean, you have people inside the Bureau who are also critical of these policies, who think this is a waste of time, and I quoted them as well. But all of this really couldn't have happened were it not for the investigative reporting program at UC Berkeley, seeing that this was an underreported topic and giving me the time and resources to pursue it.
Well, I'm glad they did, and glad we've got the book to show it. If you want to get to see the book and actually get to see Trevor, you can go to Powell's Books tonight at 7:30. The one downtown on 10th and West Burnside. He will be doing a reading. I was going to say you can check out how annotated this is. His research is very thoroughly noted in the book itself as well. I want to take on another caller right now. The next person on the line is? It's Joanne. Joanne, welcome.
Yeah, this time that I'm talking to you, I have Channel 24 on with the inauguration going on. And in front of me, I have a Portland newspaper called the Portland Observer. It has a special on Martin Luther King Jr. And at the bottom of the one page, I thought the FBI was one of Martin Luther King Jr.'s enemies. Well, on the bottom of one page is an ad. Today's FBI is for you, and it shows a photo of a young African American female. It's, I guess, it's an ad to work for them. But anyway, I'm telling you this for my own personal reasons. That stuff like this makes me feel crazy in the world.
I understand. It would make you feel crazy. It is, it's ostentatious at the least of the FBI to be having an ad right next to on a Martin Luther King celebration day, because they did really torment him with false letters, et cetera.
Yeah, and, you know, we're just now finding out the full extent of the FBI's involvement with King and his organization. You know, there was a really good reporting that was done by the Commercial Appeal, the daily paper in Memphis, mm-hmm. about this famed African-American photographer named Ernest Withers, and they ended up getting his FBI file, and they found out that Withers was actually a paid informant and was burrowing into King's organization and providing King's organization and providing information to the FBI about what was going on. There's a very clear historical record of the FBI being very aggressive and being very skeptical of King. What we see as a difference today, though, is, you know, back in the 60s under Hoover, for example, informants really were just eyes and ears. They provided information. But since the drug war in the 80s, and particularly now with the counterterrorism cases, informants are playing a larger role. They're actually getting involved in cases, almost acting, as I say in the book, as agent provocateurs.
And we've seen this in the animal rights movement as well. The Animal Terrorism Act that was passed, and there was the Green Scare, and there was a use of informants in that as well. And some of those informants did give money and assistance to have the actual acts happen, and persuaded one woman, and I think the famous one, Anna, persuaded her lover boyfriend to do acts he wouldn't want to have done, and she provided the money and the time and the vehicle. So they've been using this tactic, and we see this tactic. And the question is, you know, I think, you know, for many of us on the left, it's obviously wrong. We're outraged that they would do this kind of thing. The argument that the feds make, at least that you show in the book, Trevor, is that these people want to do this act. How are we to prevent them if we don't pursue this? So I think you prevent it by watching, if that's what you need to do, but you don't prevent it by creating.
The FBI's perspective is, you know, here's a man who says he wants to commit an act of terrorism, and what would you have us do? Would you just have us ignore him, and then we find out 6 months later, a year later, he actually commits some sort of act of terrorism? And I think it's easy to be empathetic to that view from the FBI. I mean, you wouldn't want to be the agent who makes that call, and then you find out later that the person did commit an act of terrorism. But what we see in these cases is that there really isn't that fine line between whether someone could commit an act of terrorism and whether they couldn't. It tends to be that they are just clearly, the evidence shows, incapable of committing an act of terrorism. You know, there was this really good case out of Illinois involving this man named Derek Sharif, and an informant targeted him. And, you know, Derek was broke. He was living out of his car. And the informant came to this video game store where Derek worked. And it was just before Ramadan. And he asked Derek, you know, well, I've got a place for you to live. Would you like to come live with me? And over the course of months, he persuades Derek to move forward in a plot to bomb a shopping mall, which is, you know, the informant's idea in whole. And the FBI had a problem in that Derek didn't have any money. And so all he had were these old stereo speakers. And the informant tells Derek, well,
he's living in his car, no money.
No money.
Old stereo speakers, all he owns.
All he has. And then the informant tells him, well, I know this guy who's an arms dealer, and he can provide you with grenades that we can use to attack the shopping mall. And Derek says, well, I don't have any money. And the informant then says, well, I think if you give him your stereo speakers, he'll probably just take them and say, okay, trade.
And let's stop right there. The informant's doing this because they want for court to have this young man take an overt action on his own. Is that right?
That's what they need in these cases.
Yeah, so they're doing anything to get him. Guy doesn't have any money. Okay, use your stereos to commit an overt act that they can then can say he took action towards terrorism.
Right. They need to go beyond just the talking. They need to have him commit some sort of act of terrorism. And so in that case, all the FBI could prove was that he's got a set of stereo speakers and he's willing to trade them for grenades. And so they show up in this parking lot in Illinois, and the undercover FBI agent is there posing as an arms dealer. He's got a box of five inert grenades. Derek hands over his old stereo speakers, and the FBI agent, you know, gives him the grenades, and they come in and arrest him. But there was this really revelatory line that Derek gave the informant in the middle of the sting when they're talking about what they're going to do, and Derek is expecting to make this trade for the grenades. Derek says to him, you know, if it wasn't for you, I probably would have just ended up stabbing someone with a steak knife. And to me, that was so great because that showed, if he really wanted to be a terrorist, what he was fully capable of. And it was just stabbing some random stranger with a steak knife. But instead, we ended up prosecuting him for a conspiracy to use a weapon of mass destruction, and he's serving 25 years in prison.
25 years. That's the other thing. These people are getting real sentences and really long sentences in federal prison. Well, we're going to go to the next caller now. Kevin, thank you for joining us, Kevin.
Hi, good morning, folks. How are you?
Good.
Good. Trevor, I wanted to first say thank you for writing this book. This is obviously a conversation that this nation has to have that we're not having at this point. So thank you for doing your research and homework and getting it written.
Thank you.
I wanted to bring up a couple of small points that I don't seem to hear in any conversations right now regarding this case. Certainly not in the mainstream media, but not even in, you know, kind of the activist circles. And that's the choice of using Portland to have this what amounts to a false flag take place. If memory recalls, this was right about the same time that the FBI was actually trying to re-implement the Joint Terrorism Task Force into the city of Portland. They had been kicked out a few years earlier for data mining information on peaceful activists. So the city of Portland decided no more, too much of a liability. And right at this time that this Christmas tree bombing took place, they were trying to re-implement. We had city council meetings, this sort of stuff. They had all the big wigs from the FBI showing up to testify, and we all know what came out of that. They allowed the Joint Terrorism Task Force. So that'd be my main point, is the not just the timing, but the motivation for using the city of Portland.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, it's also worth noting that Portland was the only major city in the United States that wasn't participating in a JTTF with federal law enforcement. I think this is also something that Mohammed's defense lawyers brought up in a motion, this question of whether there was an incentive by the FBI and DOJ to pursue this case as a way of pressuring Portland to join the JTTF, as a way of saying, hey, you know, you're not part of the JTTF, and look, there was a terrorist around the corner.
It's a good public way, because what I want to say is I've done some investigation on that, and the Fusion Center, the Portland area Fusion Center that's really on a CCC campus, Clackamas Community College campus, that I have toured that center. Those centers cannot exist without a JTTF. And that center was put in place April 2009, a full year before the public show of should Portland join the JTTF. And for that center to have been there, our mayor, our governor, and all of our major police departments had to have known that. I believe we really secretly joined the JTTF way back in April of 2009. I don't have any way to prove that to you, but according to all federal information, you cannot have a local fusion center without the JTTF being there already in place. So I think there were even more shenanigans going on, and it points up even more what you're saying, Dan, why they would have wanted to use this opportunity, the first great opportunity that they created, to say, see, we really need to be in the JTTF and make it public. I think the privately we were already doing it.
And when we see what they've done within this, within the confines of the city of Portland, that certainly doesn't seem like too far of a stretch of the imagination that took place, and you know, contractors were paid to build the center, and you know, they needed to follow through with it. And I'll hop off with one last point here as well, and that is, to me, the true act of terrorism in this case is the fact that the city mayor, Mayor Sam Adams, and the police chief were not notified that this was going down. So we had however many thousands of people show up at Pioneer Courthouse Square on the Christmas lighting eve, and then we had a van with a makeshift bomb in the back of it, and not one police officer was notified that this was taking place. Now, to me, if somebody had happened to look into the window or had seen a Middle Eastern man, because preconceived notions, standing next to a van with a big drum in it, what type of panic and terror do you think would have ensued if nobody knew that this was actually going on? And what type of scene could that have created had something slipped up and somebody saw something that was alarming like that? That's the true act of terrorism.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, that's a good question. What if this had been discovered and there was a public panic that, you know, people began to think, you know, what if somebody started screaming bomb and because they thought there was a bomb, the real bomb in the car? But I also think it's revelatory because it shows how little danger there was in these terrorism sting cases. You know, there was a man in D.C. who was plotting to bomb the metro system, and when the case was announced, of course, the media are saying, you know, breathlessly, "Well, was anyone in danger?" And the FBI has to say, "Well, no, we had the thing under control the whole time. The bombs were inert. There was no danger to anyone." And I think that's the other side of this, which is it just shows how little capacity there was. There really, you know, other than that you know, threat that there would be some kind of chaos resulting from someone suspecting a bomb was there, there really was no need to alarm the local officials for any reason, because there really wasn't a bomb. It was just part of this, you know, FBI act that was put on.
And, you know, another, speaking to that, and thank you, Dan, for your call, another part of that was actually where, I just lost it. My brain just went blank. So we'll go on to our next caller. Neil, thank you for joining us.
Hi, I'm not Neil, but I'll join you.
Oh, who are you?
My name's Sharon.
Hi, Sharon. Thank you for joining us.
Okay, this is a case that I hope Mother Jones will thoroughly investigate. I've been looking at it very carefully. And that is to address the possibility of contrived domestic terrorism, which also may give Homeland Security something to do. I think the FBI and the CIA were combined now after 9/11 into Homeland Security, weren't they?
No.
CIA is separate.
Oh, okay. CIA is still separate, but
separate.
Other, you know, FEMA and other things were rolled into Homeland Security.
Yeah, okay. and through the Joint Terrorism Task Force that we mentioned earlier, you know, you have greater cooperation with the FBI, the ATF, Immigration and Customs, and such on.
Okay, what I wanted to address, and it's a sore point at the moment, but I'm going to address it anyway. There are a lot of really strange facts and questions surrounding this Sandy Hook case, which I see as a possibility of these entities that you're investigating wanting to put people in a state of continuous upset. And when you look at what we have now, we have the advantage of the internet YouTube sites, and we can very carefully go over these events in real time and analyze them very carefully. And if there's anything that Americans know about, it's movies, because we've been watching them since we were kids. So there's a lot of strange anomalies. The strange behavior of the parents, the no tears shed by the principal people, bad acting. It just looks like bad acting.
So you're thinking that the Sandy Hook case may be something that someone should be investigating in terms of, did it really happen as the public narrative thinks it did?
Exactly.
Well, thank you for that, Sharon. I'll put that out there to the world and let others do their looking at that. I believe we have one more caller on the line. The number is 503-231-8187. Just before I take that next caller, I do want to go ahead and mention what's going to be on our radio show today. I mean, on our radio station today at 9, it's going to be Old Mole Variety Hour. Today's show includes Dr. Martin Luther King and would he have supported Barack Obama, conversation about gun violence, and much more. At 10, it's Air Cascadia with locally produced news interviews and just plain horse sense with Chris Andre. And then at 10:15, we'll hear Locus Focus with host Barbara Bernstein. Today, she's going to take a look at British Petroleum and the company's history of noncompliance with federal environmental regulations. Her guest is Abraham Lutzgarten, who's been following BP's past and present crimes against the environment for ProPublica. And then starting at 11, we'll have special programming for most of the day. KBOO's going to go live, as we do every year, to New Beginnings Conference Center this year for the live coverage of Keep the Dream Alive, Portland's annual tribute to the life and work of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. So that's what's coming up on Portland Radio. I want to go to that next caller and any of the rest of you who would like to get in. It's now time to pick up your phones, 503-231-8187. And Neil, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Great show. I want to ask a question about the response or the movement response to this kind of effort, and I want to ask that broadly. So in relationship, for example, to the Aaron Swartz suicide and the campaign that's beginning about that as prosecutorial overreach, and I'm just wondering, in other words, there are so many details about all of these cases and all of these issues, and admiring the work of the specifics of countering them, but also asking about general response movements and ways to curb this kind of injustice. And so looking at that part of the field and saying, well, really one of the more high-profile recent events is this Aaron Swartz and the reasons for his suicide. And then even more broadly, that is being framed, as I see it, as bullying and state bullying, and I'm wondering about that as a general characterization of this kind of misbehavior by the state. And I just would mention one other element of it is the torture victims worldwide, which, you know, many of which were really just people who were turned in for money and then tortured without the CIA even knowing who they were, really.
Thank you, Neil, for those. That's really good points you're bringing up.
I think, you know, the interesting thing about the Aaron Swartz case and how it's similar to some of these cases is, you know, that it shows the extraordinary power that federal prosecutors have. You know, the conviction rate in federal courts is well over 90%. You know, if you're charged with a federal crime, it's really hard to beat it. You know, in Aaron Swartz's case, this was it struck me as being a civil case. You know, he essentially violated the JSTOR terms of agreement, and neither JSTOR nor, I believe, MIT wanted him prosecuted, and yet you have federal prosecutors pursuing these charges anyway with pretty stiff sentences. And that's also another thing that's worth mentioning in these federal cases is that they're, you know, if you go to trial, you face what are called mandatory minimum sentences that are legislatively set. And, you know, so, for example, in terrorism cases, the reason we have so many guilty pleas is because if you go to trial, you're going to face 25, 35 years in prison, huge amounts of time. And these mandatory minimums were written with, you know, true terrorists in mind, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, for example. But instead, you know, because the FBI is giving capacity to these people that, you know, they otherwise wouldn't have, you know, there's no way, for example, a Mohammed on his own could have built the bomb that they needed to bring a conspiracy to use a weapon of mass destruction against him. But the FBI provided that means, and now they're able to charge him under, you know, if he's convicted, sentencing guidelines that will put him in jail for 25 or 35 years. And I think what we're seeing is kind of this enormous power of federal prosecutors. How you lobby against that, I'm not quite sure. I mean, this has been a system that's been built over decades.
Well, and I think both the good thing and the different thing about the Aaron Swartz case is that Aaron Swartz is a young, educated white man who's made huge contributions to the society as a whole via his computer work. And many of us have been touched by him, whether it was the battles around SOPA or that kind of thing. And then the people that the FBI are going after in the Muslim communities, these are the most marginalized. They're not going after the successful businessman who's a Muslim. They're going after the most marginalized parts of a community that's already been demonized in the media and movies and press throughout. And I think that is a significant difference. What I'd love to see is any kind of action that's going on around Aaron Swartz. And I know there are people taking action around this right now to change laws, and that I'd love to see that be able to bleed over into these cases where people don't feel as much affinity or as much that could be my brother, that could be my cousin. And when I say people, I mean the majority white population that votes and gives money to the government, because that's who they care about, what their feelings are. And so I think there is a significant difference in who ended up being the victim of the bullying, but that the bullying and the overreaching is clearly a pattern that goes on within the federal government.
Right. And I would say that part of this is, too, is also bureaucratic. You know, we have billions allocated for counterterrorism. You know, there's been an increasing budget for cyber crimes and, you know, the perceived threat of cyber terrorism. And whether that played a role in Swartz's case is hard to determine right now. But, I mean, what we are seeing is that the increase in, you know, these terrorism cases, the bringing in of these, you know, men on the margins who on their own don't have capacity, really falls in line with the increase in funding to make, you know, these types of cases possible.
And so the militarization of police is really a good example of that. If your local police forces are having budget shrinkage because of the economic crisis that came about because of the elite, and then federal money is offered to your local police department, but you have to buy these kinds of things and you have to do these kinds of activities, then you see these armored vehicles we have here in Portland and these guys coming so armored up to every event. And we now have 4 license plate Tagger vehicles in Portland. We didn't buy those. That's Homeland Security money. And so I think it's really important what you're saying. If you put the money there, people will fill in to utilize it. I also think there was a famous quote from one of Stalin's, the head of the secret police, the Stasi there. And what he said was, "You show me the man and I'll show you the crime." Meaning, anyone can be scrutinized enough and looked at enough and manipulated enough to be able to bring a crime to court. And I think that our FBI is behaving very much like that state police.
I quote an FBI agent in the book, actually, who says, if you focus more resources on a problem, you'll find lots of problems. And that's certainly what
it's
we're
It's the same having. Thing. Yeah, exactly. And I think we see that happening. Well, thank you for that call. We have another caller on the line. We have a couple more callers in just a little bit of time. And I think he said Dana. We've got Dana on the line.
That is correct. This is Dana on the line. I will be as succinct as possible. First, I want to thank Trevor for the work. What really caught my attention was your linking the funding of security operations to kind of creating inflated terrorism scenarios. This issue impacts me directly because my brother, lives in western Pennsylvania, was ensnared in one of these operations and wound up spending 18 months in jail without bail, pending trial, at the end of which most of the charges were dismissed. And they were trying to get him on domestic terrorism and, you know, regarding militias. He was a gun owner and, you know, had an extensive gun collection. And so anyway,
so they can use those powers in many directions. It's not just what we would necessarily think of as this kind of terrorism case.
Absolutely. And your quote regarding Stalin, find the man and I will figure out, you know, what he did, how he is a criminal, that directly applies to him. He is, a really sweet guy, heavily community involved, but he's in one of those, you know, extreme opinions about the Second Amendment area where, you know, a lot of people perceive that as crazy, and it just sort of fits into that backcountry attitude. So I'll take my comments off the air, but if you look into June of 2008, Lucinda, Pennsylvania, if you want to do any research on that, Trevor, thank you for your time.
I'll be happy to look it up. Thank you.
Well, and thank you. And, you know, we did have another caller, but we're not going to be able to take you. We have run out of town. I want to let people know that you've been listening to More Talk Radio, and my guest has been Trevor Aronson. He's the author of The Terror Factory, Inside the FBI's Manufactured War on Terrorism. There was much more that we didn't get to, how they use the same informants, how many of their informants are actually the real criminal with violent histories. There's a lot more to hear, and he will be doing a reading tonight at Powell's Books on 10th and West Burnside at 7:30 a.m. I want to thank all of you for listening to KBOO's More Talk Radio.
January 18, 2013. KABU Navigator Report. Overwhelming support and a record number of donations were received at the close of 2012. Thank you, KABU donors. 6 months of hard work have resulted in a more knowledgeable board and updated board policies, completing a grant from the Meyer Memorial Trust. A new partnership with mainstreamed media will give reporters with developmental disabilities a voice on the KABU Evening News. The KABU Council of Elders will be gathering in March. For more information, contact Lynn Fitch, 503-231-8032, extension 222, or navigator at kboo.org. This has been the weekly Navigator Report. Thank you.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down, and I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland, where the time is almost 9:02, and time for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Clayton Morgridge, along with our engineer, Joe Clement, bringing you an hour of critical analysis and radical ideas for change. As Ursula Le Guin says in her novel, The Dispossessed, you can't crush ideas by suppressing them. You can only crush them by ignoring them, by refusing to think, refusing to change. Well, the old mole works to keep ideas for change alive so they cannot be ignored. On today's show, we'll be hearing about Quentin Tarantino's new shoot 'em up black exploitation spaghetti western, Django Unchained. We'll hear a discussion of gun violence and the gun control debate, an exploration into what a sustainable economy in harmony with nature would be like, and a conversation about how differences and convergences between anarchism and Marxism play out in today's political movements. We'll also hear some music by some local performers. You can listen to this show or any part of it again or tell your friends about it. Just go to kboo.fm/oldmolevarietyhour.